Checking back in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for another Tacky Talk podcast. Hey, Tacky, how are you?
Good to see you, Joe. As you can tell, my life has gotten busier, given the fact scheduling has been slightly more difficult than it has been. So when I say I see you in a week, it tends to be two suddenly.
Yep, it has been a couple of weeks since we last chatted, although we have seen each other in person at the Father Bill's ribbon cutting event. That was kind of nice.
That was actually very exciting. This is something we've talked about with Joe Finn and then Yaz after Joe about, honestly about uniform, but also what's the right words to use here? Uniform's not the right word. I think the way to put it is one-stop shopping for individuals to move on in their lives in a positive manner to ensure that they have the skills necessary to do so. Far too often, we tend to be as a society just dropping people out of the blue, for lack of a better term, someplace and, let them figure out and hope for the best. But people tend to also forget there's also stigma associated with homelessness. And I can't speak to every single person's background, but I'm sure there's some challenges of some people, not all people, some people, regarding escaping homelessness and, having a more facility that provides a multi-services to those individuals to prepare and help them move along their lives or go along the way. And as I was taught by both Joe and Yaz, having a safe place to put your head down at night goes a long way psychologically.
It's really flipping the whole model. It's really neat to see that they're trying to tackle it head on before it becomes a chronic issue. If folks are maybe on the verge of becoming homeless, stop that from happening.
Yeah, them neighborhood works, QCAP, do a lot of work and try to work with landlords, try to provide some assistance on cutting it off in the past, so to speak, as try to do evictions. We are very much a pro-tenant state. So it is very difficult to evict individuals. But there's also housing discrimination issues that have been arising. To yesterday's public hearing, one of the bills that we're looking at involves further study regarding rental discrimination. Suffolk Law School did a study during the pandemic period and actually before the pandemic and through the pandemic regarding whether or not race, gender, and socioeconomic status has an impact on renters to be able to rent. And the answer is a resounding yes, it appears, based on this study. The committee last year, and they will recommend probably again this year, that further study is needed by what's going to become the Secretary of Housing under Ed Augustus to look further into whether the sound of your voice, the amount of money you make, the where were you born or where community you come out of, and the appearance you have will impact landlords' desire to take you as a renter. And we're not realtors should have be raised to a high level of responsibility to help people find housing work on ensuring fair housing with landlords. And that's a good question. I don't have an easy answer for you. The answer obviously should be yes. But how do you do it, right? There's a lot of yeses in my life, but the question is how. But it is a legit issue. So, Father Bill's, new facility is absolutely wonderful. Again, something we've talked about with Joe and Yaz for many years. I fully support consolidated services and the ability for people to provide a guide path of in the real world. Also the flip side, my committee is looking at, potential renter discrimination based on a Suffolk Law study.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know that the Healey administration has made affordable housing a priority and really created an entire new kind of secretary for that position. Did you not?
Yes, the affordable housing is a challenge. You have a lot going on here, right? Everyone knows about 40B at this point, right? You don't have 10% affordable housing. Anyone building affordable housing doesn't need permission from the city to build affordable housing. So, we're all aware of that, but clearly the carrot and stick approach to communities has not always worked out because you have the ability to pay into the Affordability Housing Trust Fund to bypass needing to provide 10% affordable housing. And, people still want Section 8 and MSRVPs, which is the state version of Section 8, and there's only so much to go around. And even then, their income driven by the rent in the area. It actually is, you still have to pay money. It's not a free voucher. But you still need to pay a percentage, I think up to 30% or plus, to give in the type of voucher of the average market rate in the greater Boston area. And the rental rates are very high in this area. So Section 8, you know, still not, it's, you know, much better market rate, but still pretty substantial for working working folks. You know, you don't have to be on public assistance to qualify. You can't have a job, but, you know, there's income guidelines to be met. And you don't meet a certain income guideline, you can't qualify for this program. So it's a lot of folks that are, you know, struggling on that front. And yeah, it's hard. So I'm not sure how affordable housing is going to work, because the housing stock, and, you know, or is the administration going to take some very bold plans, either working or not working with developers regarding how to do this? And of course, you got municipal pushback.
Exactly. Yeah, the whole not in my backyard issues, right?
Yeah, I mean, the state could try to build on its own lands, and there ain't that much land, to be honest with you. The state doesn't own a lot of land. It is an environmental sensitive land. So, you know, what kind of carrot and sticks are available? And interest rates approaching over 3% on the mortgages now. You know, will commercial development look for government for lower rate incentives to build, or did it wait it out, you know, for a couple of years? And as the cycles, rates will go back down. When interest rates were close to 0%, there was actually no need for government incentivization for development.
Right. All the, you know, the Fed's talking about possibly more rate hikes later this year.
I agree that's going to happen. Core inflation is still really stubborn. I think it's at 5.3. Core inflation is everything but energy and
food.
And that's trapped at 5.3, of housing obviously being the biggest cost at a national level. So yeah, expect perhaps another 0.5 in total, 2.5, two more 2.5s coming. What's it? 0.25s. More 0.25 interest rates are coming. The stickiness of it. And as a committee chair, consumer and professional relationship, I've certainly paid significantly more attention to cost of living issues the last couple of years. I know you guys keep hearing me talk about these numbers, and it seems like I pay too much attention, but suddenly I have to pay more attention because the myriad of industries I deal with and the impacts on prices.
It does. It absolutely does impact everything. Yeah, that the Fed's looking for more of like a 2% inflation rate. So still a ways to go.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think the news report said Jerome Powell told the House of Representatives Financial Service Committee. I'm not sure what they call them down there.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. And you know, they think maybe 2% inflation may hit in over a year's time.
Right.
May. Yep. So, I mean, as I said before, I can't tell you what you do with your money, but definitely look up, definitely find the best interest rate for your money right now, because you're probably not going to see this again in like two or three, in probably another maybe 2 years from now, we'll see these interest rates like this again.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Make your passive money work for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, best you can, for sure. Can we talk a little bit about the now the right to repair law in Massachusetts and how the federal government's telling the state to ignore it, basically?
Yeah, this is a drama. This is a drama. So about, you know, almost a decade now, we passed again a correct language regarding so-called right to repair, where your third-party mechanic has the ability to get the same materials, instructions, and diagnostic tools physical tools from a manufacturer, the same as a dealership's repair shop can. And we create that right about 10 or so years ago, and it seemed to be working just fine. So then the third-party car guys came back. They put a ballot question in 2020 to, was it 2020? Time's really strange right now. But they would put a ballot question that would give third-party car mechanics remote information on the telemetrics of your car. It's a very broad term, what telemetrics mean. And what does that mean to you as a consumer? It means your car, which has a wireless device in it, generally it's a 3G-ish transmitter or 4G low-end transmitter, which transmit regular data to the manufacturers regarding the condition of your car to ensure that if your car has a hazard, meaning recall, they know it right away. Most people may have not noticed this, but recall on parts have been happening a lot despite no actual accidents happening, because the car's able to diagnostic system will tell them you have a problem, recall these parts right now, which does happen. Well, the third-party mechanics want the same diagnostic information sent to their businesses, not to the manufacturer. And it's a two-way street. Once you open up the signal between your car and the repair shop, and that means if they're clever enough and they got the right technology on their side, they're able to, for lack of a better term, you know, hack your system and find out everything from your GPS to your weight, because some cars actually do have weight sensors, I found out. And the National Highway Safety Board has issued a letter filed with the First District Court U.S. judge here that the telemetric system provides us inherent safety danger contrary to the National Highway Safety Act regarding vehicle safety. And the reasons, as I described, they can actually, you know, third parties that isn't a car manufacturer can hack your data, collect information about you. They could resell that data to somebody else. They could use the track where you live and where you go. And they can also perhaps, you know, send advertising back to your display. And they also got ability to perhaps, you know, convince you to come get your car fixed, whether you realize you need a car fixed or not, because they figured why not? They can send, you know, if they can hack the system. And people are like, well, this isn't, you know, a big deal because it's not true. Well, hacking is a big deal because it's happening everywhere, right? I mean, the state system is being hacked as we speak, just whether they can get past the firewall. Those same securities are not in your car because it only has one place that transmit and receives from, and it's the manufacturer. And the manufacturer data protection is a single location, and the only way anyone can get it is the feds kind of issue a subpoena for someone specific. There is no equal protection there, and it also allows the third-party mechanics to sell your stuff off your car computer. And you'd be surprised. That includes things like your phone numbers. Some of you probably have cars hooked up to imports contacts. Some of you may have phones that can, you know, they hook up with music, and also directly hook up to your phone. Your phone unlocks, or it may be still locked, but it's unlocked for the purpose of connecting to your car, which then, you know, car collects that data to function the display, which then can be collected by a third party through the wireless transmission. And some of you may have OnStar, and some of you may have onboard GPS. Well, there's a regular update of those maps and the software in your car remotely to make sure that the map's updated and any system software is done. And if you have OnStar, you know, obviously it's designed to track where you are in case there's a car accident and you need roadside help. And you saw in the Globe article, Subaru has, I believe Subaru has decided not to allow the OnStar system, which is a feature people pay for but no longer can have. And newer vehicles are made up of Model 21s. And, you know, Highway Safety Board pointed out that, you know, you're now taking out safety devices in vehicles that are literally designed to make it safer. Mm-hmm. And that if the manufacturer side that all of them decide to eliminate transmission ability of their cars, I mean, that actually is a public safety to you, because you're not because the manufacturers care about where you, you know, where you drive to or who you make phone calls to, but it, you know, they need to know what the diagnostics of your car is saying. So they reach a certain number, they know to call, recall right away.
Right. And, you know, talk about access to your phones. A lot of folks have home security systems tied to their phones. They can lock and unlock doors in their homes. They have video cameras. So the possibilities there are pretty scary.
Yeah. And you get to like really like high tech cars like Teslas, right? I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit before, but you know, my brother can remote his Tesla from his phone. He's able to talk through the car. He's able to know what the car is at all times, charging battery, all that data is sitting in that car, and car mechanics, third party car mechanics, wants that data constantly transmitted to their shops.
So what happens from here, Jackie? Is it going to be ended up in court again?
Well, we had no clue how Attorney General Campbell was going to enforce this to begin with, because those model cars already been out the door. Your car model isn't the year you sell the car in. It's the year you're in. They sell next year's car models, particularly once you get to the second half of the year. Secondly, you know, it's been sitting in a judge's desk in the First Circuit for like 3 years. And my committee's been kind of hanging out, waiting to see what the judge does so we can actually change laws based on the court opinion, with the knowledge is probably going to be appealed. But the National Highway Safety Board actually filing this letter and filing this letter with the First Circuit judge, I think they just made the judge's life a lot easier making a ruling.
Yeah. Right, exactly. It's the decision's already been made for him.
Yeah, and it's done by, you can claim supremacy clause on this matter is an interstate commerce issue, because cars by nature are interstate commerce because you move your cars between states. You buy a car between states, you transport cars between states. Parts of cars are, all car parts are interstate by nature. So, actually globally now, as we discovered during COVID, right? So, you know, you can say that, you know, there are National Highway Safety Board and the feds, you know, has the ability to strike this clause unconstitutional because it violates the Commerce Clause and Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution. So those are just two of the options he may choose. I mean, he may choose other options, not being privy to the inner workings of the court. But it's, you know, but personally speaking, I think people's data should not be given to third-party mechanics.
Yeah, I know you were against this from the beginning. I know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they voted yes. I guess you don't mind your data going to third-party mechanics so they know where you live at all times and whether you shop and where you work and, you know, what roads you like to take.
Right, yeah. And that's, I mean, ton of money was spent on both sides of that ballot question, you know, for and against. So it's kind of interesting to see it off or not.
Again, another cautionary tale I tell everybody. I mean, a good slogan doesn't mean good law.
Right, right.
And obviously, you know, we have legislation on the Hill that people try to, you know, create creative titles for and try to market it through these creative titles. And of course, ballot questions are the same thing. Mm-hmm. And given a, you know, ballot question process, bypass the legislature. And I sometimes kind of actually do my homework, people. And as a committee chair that oversees this matter, I've been dealing with this matter for a decade as a committee member, not just a committee chair. Kind of sort of been doing some stuff, learning to understand how this works, not just the law, but also the actual mechanics of some of these things in a real life world situation. So, yeah.
So score one for Tacky. Check.
Every so often, I sometimes am right. It does happen occasionally. It doesn't always happen as often as you think it does, though. But sometimes I'm right.
Speaking of talking about transportation issues, let's talk about the RMV getting ready to issue licenses for undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, the legislature passed a bill to allow a certain limited number of undocumented immigrants to be able to acquire a Massachusetts driver's license that is not a real ID one, that only the feds can qualifications for real ID. And it went before the ballot last cycle, and the voters upheld this privilege to give folks driver's licenses. So it was not just voted in the legislature, but the voters upheld the law. So the Registry of Motor Vehicles has been spending some time trying to understand how to implement this law, and they've been actually very narrowly following the statute, which is one, you have to have a valid passport of country of origin or a consulate document verifying identification of country of origin, which they actually did reach out to consulates to find out what their documents look like so they don't get forgeries. So they are on top of this one, actually. We did have a briefing with the RMV and asked some really great questions about implementation. And they're really, you know, into this fraud stuff. Like, you know, you can't give them stuff that isn't valid, right? You need a driving drive-in school completion, which most of us, actually all of us, don't require unless they're undocumented. So obviously they've been in touch with the driving schools. They know who they all are. And they will, you know, verify that you did complete the program successfully. And of course, you got to go in for application and driving exam, just like everybody else. So you just have to take the test, written test, and complete the driving exam. And, you know, they're preparing to do multilingual to help assist folks on the application process, as well as, you know, driving exam process. Not new necessarily on multilingual, but they've actually beefed up much significantly because they expect a rapid deluge of applications, and they'll just kind of calm down after the initial rush. So they're gearing up on July 1st to just prepare for a wave, and then the wave will die down, and you know that's how kind of these things happen, right? So you have to meet those three criterias to get a driver's license. And as you can tell, it's an identification challenge. It is a personal expense. You have to pay for a driving school. And then, of course, you have to pass the course itself and pay the fees and associated to the RMV. So it is definitely a combination of financial burden as well as self-burden to provide identification.
And I know that the Attorney General is issuing kind of a warning, if you will, or an alert for folks not to be scammed by these, you know, third parties that might be reaching out, claiming that they can get them a driver's license. It should only be through the RMV.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, if there's a scam to be taken, someone's going to do it, right? So obviously, you can reach out to my office. We can try to be helpful and contact the RMV with you. But most definitely, you know, do not trust any third party to get any kind of legal document of any sort of any kind. That's why you have your state and federal delegations to try to help you out. Obviously, you got passports or naturalization papers or other things of that sort. You go see Congressman Lynch, Senator Warren, Senator Markey. You know, state-related issues, we'll do our best to help you out. You know, part of things like proven residency. So beyond just confirmation of identification by passport, you have to confirm residency. Like all of us do the same thing, you know, credit card bills, utility bills, landlord, tenant agreements, I mean, whatever, to prove residency, right? So, you know, RMV will have a set of documents up on their website on how this will be working. I do think there's going to be a lot of confusion personally, I think, initially. But I think it's going to iron itself out. Yeah, but I mean, you should never trust any third party to get you any form of government documents for identification or licensing or any other purposes.
Right. And one good warning sign is here in Massachusetts, at least, it's called the RMV. It's the Registry of Motor Vehicles, not the DMV like some other states.
Yeah, you know you're not local if you say DMV.
That's right. So what else is going on Beacon Hill these days, Jackie? I saw a photograph not too long ago of several folks standing on a balcony inside the State House dropping trow.
Dropping trow?
Yes.
Trow like
environmental activists.
You mean dropping trow.
Mooning, essentially.
Okay, I thought you were saying that we were dropping gardening tools off the balcony of the State House.
Trousers. That's an old-fashioned term, I know.
All right. I was like, I don't remember anyone getting arrested for throwing stuff off the State House balcony this week. But there's been some environmental folks, and there's not a lot of them. I mean, it isn't like there's 100 of them. They're a very small number that had caused some commotion in the House chamber at one point, and then they decided to run to the Senate chamber somewhat later on during a formal session and proceeded to display their selves.
And something that, years, if you say, yeah.
Well, stuff that people used to do when they were much younger and dumber, I think is the way to do it. I don't expect full-grown mature adults to be doing this, much less doing it sober, I suspect, but I did not meet them, so I can't confirm that.
Okay.
Yeah, no, this is juvenile stuff when I was young, too. You see teenagers and young kids doing this to people. But
these were not kids.
These were not kids. And it's very unfortunate. I mean, you want to be taken seriously on issues important to you. You should provide the same level of respect and seriousness to the people you talk to. And this display, while it's great for a quick headline on State House News Service, you know, only doesn't help their cause and their messaging, but it's quite frankly embarrassing as full-grown adults who should be better examples to the public, particularly on important causes like environmental issues.
And interestingly, I think, you know, Massachusetts is probably one of the leading states when it comes to seeking out renewable energy sources.
We absolutely are. We've talked about this many times the last 4 years, especially regarding windmill development. We'll be the first major offshore developer purchasing power for them. We're obviously interested in purchasing power for Hydro-Quebec. There is no regular coal burning plant. We do have an emergency coal plant just in case, you know, World War III breaks out. And at that point, we're kind of like whatever it takes to right. get the industrial machine going. God forbid we find ourselves in a situation. So we do have emergency coal in case of like nuclear war or something, but you know, natural gas is what we could burn to, and even in natural gas plants are declining in Massachusetts. We don't burn oil here. Most of our non-fossil fuel burning, if you get like a coal or oil situation, is actually imported. Well, I won't say all of it, but most of it's imported from out of state during very cold weather periods. For example, this past winter, when we had high peak load, There was a lot of issues regarding supply ability, and New England actually had to use coal and oil for brief periods this past winter.
Yeah.
But for the most part, a combination of people being able to install their own new power units at their home, generally solar panels, I continue to encourage energy saving through Mass Save and energy efficiency programs. I mean, I got a Nest at the home. It really does a great job regulating our furnace and our cooling system. I couldn't believe how much power we're saving as a result of one little device that was installed at the house. And obviously, changing labels and being mindful of unplugging things, right? I mean, it's, common sense. Turn off the lights when you leave the house, leave on the safety lights, so to speak. You also have the advent of electric cars, and they do put a strain on the grid because power comes from somewhere. And, those are kind of the future things we need to start thinking about, where we're going to get more renewable power. If there's any more renewable power we've got, try to do more electrification. And as you've heard me in the past, you got to move hand in hand. You can't just decide, electrifying a system, but you got no power to provide the system. And then we fall back on coal and oil, which is what we saw this past winter.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we had that super cold snap, but when it's 20 below out, you don't really care how you're getting your heat. You just want it.
I agree. Most people don't care about how things happen when you turn on your lights. They just want their lights on and they're wearing their heating on. But as we add more things to the electrical grid away from natural gas, particularly things like heating, you need to get the power somewhere. During cold snaps, again, heating prioritization of electricity, gas-powered electricity generators in Massachusetts will not get the gas they need, go to heating instead, forces to buy electricity from outside of Massachusetts, and the dirtiest options will be coming online quickly because they'll be the cheapest options in the bid process, and then we're stuck burning something dirty. So, people have beaten me up a little bit about this stuff, but there is a practicality to all this in the sense that you can't add things to your power supply, power grid, if you don't provide supply. It's like plugging like 18 things in one wall socket.
Yeah.
Something's going to give on your wiring system, particularly on your circuit breaker at some point, right? And it's the same principle, right? You're going to jam, 18 things in a wall socket, but on a big level, and the results are not going to be good.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to put cart before the horse, quite literally, almost. Yeah, exactly.
It can't be done. But, people, again, like I said, you turn on the electric switch, people don't care about how electricity got there. Same thing with folks on trying to provide more power. They don't care about the details associated with all these intricate parts of, you and me in our house, trying to make sure that, lights stay on, the heat stays on, because it doesn't snap. You can't snap your fingers and make it overnight. And people have this perception, you pass a law, godlike powers come from the sky and windmills are suddenly placed in the water.
Yeah, no, there's no magic to it, unfortunately. It might happen in our lifetime. It might not. Who knows?
It's funny when I have conversations with folks I just have in real now, and they kind of look at me like, you believe God's going to drop windmills out of the sky? Go for it. I just find it mind-boggling personally.
Yeah. So the new fiscal year begins in July, is that right?
We are waiting for the budget. As we've talked in the past, there is not a lot going on in the House right now. We did front load a lot of stuff at the beginning of the year, which is kind of my detriment now because we don't have anything really fascinating to vote on, right? We did, a tax package. We did a economic development bill. We did a transportation bond bill. We had Chapter 90 transportation bond bill. A lot of small supplemental budgets to fill in costs associated with things like school breakfast remainder of the year, pandemic relief issues that we're providing for that we're not sure how it's going to fit their main budget, but we filled the gap in the feds cut us off on several related items that they were using for emergencies. And we just kind of filled a gap for a little while until the fiscal year begins. We really kind of, Speaker kind of really front loaded the year. So as a result, now we're waiting for committees to go through the process of public hearings. I'm trying to get my public hearings done by August 1st, trying to get everything out of my committee in terms of public hearings so we can have more time to deliberate with my co-chair and the staff of what we're going to do for work in the fall in terms of preparing our priorities for bills and committee. It's hard for me to explain to folks that we kind of front-loaded everything in the House.
It was a very busy spring for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. The Senate is now doing the stuff we sent over prior to the House budget debate in April. And they've been now moving through that and starting conference committees on things like Chapter 90, things like, you know, the tax packages form a conference committee this week. So, you know, that conversation will continue. But the budget is the big one. June 30th is our budget deadline. End of fiscal year. I fully expect the Speaker's office will put out notice this Friday to have us on call to go to the State House when the budget's done. The budget, under the rules, required to be reported out before 8 p.m. the day before a vote. So it could be a very fast notice, depending on the timing of when they complete that. But the legislature in the past have worked very hard to try to get a bill on the governor's by June 30th. Will pass a small, like, deficiency carryover, supplemental budget, whatever you want to call it, to cover 10 days into this fiscal cycle, just as a holdover until the budget is signed. And this is Governor Healey's first budget. It'll be very interesting to see how they deal with the various things that they thought were important to them, but is important to us. It was important to them. Isn't what, you know, we want, maybe not what they want. So it'll be interesting to see how that this governor handles that in the 10-day time period.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's, I mean, yeah, the governor administration can, you know, make suggestions and recommendations and ideas, but I mean, unless the legislature approves it, it dies in where it is.
And the first budget is hard, folks. I mean, the governor's first budget is not an easy go. It's your first really kind of like foray to negotiating with the legislature. And, you know, power pocket, I mean, a line out of vetoes means you can just line it out. Parts of the budget, you don't have to reject the whole budget. You know, you can amend the budget, you can rewrite sections and send it back to us. And, you know, we may like it, we may not like it. We may do something, we may not do something. And it creates like a new negotiation that as Attorney General she didn't have to do. So the first one's always hard. I'm just going to tell everybody. I mean, it's right. Watching. People forget, I've been here watching Weld, Salucci, Swift, Romney, Patrick, now Baker, now Healey. So I'm watching Governor number 8 in my lifetime. I do a lot of observation as part of being on the Hill, both staffing and now as elected. And everyone's different. But there's certain universal rules. The first budget's hard.
Yeah. Well, she has some experience. She had to create a budget while she was Attorney General. And of course, Kim Driscoll created a municipal budget as Mayor of Salem. So they have some experience.
Some experience, but not the same. The difference is the power to veto and the legislature to, you know, not do what you want. Right. Being a strong mayor in Salem, the council, like in Quincy, can only cut, they can't add.
Right.
And once it reached the mayor's desk, the mayor doesn't cut the budget there. The mayor signs it because, you know,
because it's his budget or her budget.
His budget. I mean, yes. You don't start vetoing your own budget. So that's it's a different dynamic where the legislature, you know, is a partner. We do have like power regarding these things is in the Constitution. And again, we can decide that, you know, we don't like what you're thinking and we'll just override you.
Right. Exactly. I want to talk a little bit about, I saw this morning, the employees at Encore Casino are going on strike.
Yeah, I didn't read that yet, but I'm not too surprised. I mean, given an increase of pay, problems, you know, hyperinflation, a little surprised they just go find new jobs because right now, I mean, it's a pro worker market. I think the Massachusetts employment rate is actually lower than the national unemployment rate.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like 3.7 nationally. And I haven't got the latest state one, but we've been below the national one.
A little bit, but like 3.4, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just about close to full employment for the purposes of employment calculation, close to it. You know, not too surprised. I mean, cost of living's up. The casinos have done pretty well coming out of pandemic. And the cost of living is rising, and people that work at Encore, you know, tend to be in the dense urban areas in Greater Boston. Greater Boston's expensive, and you know, they're looking for, you know, better benefits because it's eating into their money. I'm kind of guessing here; I haven't read the article yet, as you can tell, but it's not surprising. It's happened to a lot of employees in general. Employees are still migrating around for the best offer. Employers have been, you know, still increasing wage. The last average wage increase was still over 4% per month over month. It compounds after time when you do month after month.
Right.
Wage increases. So, and I still believe it's double digit increases to retain employees by employers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's interesting to see how that pans out for sure. Have you heard anything more about office occupancy in the metro urban areas? You know, folks less opt to work from home now?
Well, I've been talking anecdotally to some businesses. I won't name all the businesses about what they're doing. And they're trying to migrate people back to the office. Hybrid is here to stay in some format in many non-front-facing jobs. But some people migrating people now from, 2 days a week to 3 days a week to 4 days, kind of easing people back to the office to get 5 days a week in non-front-facing job positions is pretty challenging for folks. I think, things are happening because traffic's not that great. Those of you who have been driving into Boston, particularly Tuesday through Thursday, have been finding that traffic is kind of not good. I've obviously experienced it. I have to stay at house. Quincy to Boston ain't that far. So it isn't like we're going far here. And there goes the full Boston accent.
I love it when you do that.
Yeah, I generally, folks, I actually do control my R's when I talk to folks and that aren't from good, around here.
No question that you're from here.
Yeah, no, I do put the R's back in when I'm talking to folks not from Massachusetts. It is bad. I mean, whether it be, 8:30 on the road or 11:30 on the road. And the working hours are still kind of erratic. I mean, if I have to get out early from the state house back to Quincy, I'm trying to get on the road by 3 p.m. I'm still trapped for 45 minutes getting back to Quincy. But the office spaces don't reflect it. Downtown Crossing, you walk around, a lot of those businesses that serve office buildings are still dead.
I know. It makes me wonder, who are all these people and where are they going?
Yeah, it's very perplexing. It is very perplexing. I mean, I'm aware, talking to other business folks, particularly, white collar, non-front facing, I said before, 3 days a week is not uncommon now. People try to migrate to building 4. But traffic kind of reflects, going through the city as people do go into Boston, because it isn't like, once you get past the other side of the tunnel, it's not so bad.
Right.
Except for the folks trying to get into Cambridge, they have to eat up that lane. But coming down south, my colleague Donald Wong comes out of Saugus, he's trapped at the overpass, for a good 30 minutes, at 9 a.m. Trying to get to Boston. So, yeah, I am. It's very strange. It is very strange tracking patterns. And I'm actually waiting to see how the summer goes. I'm aware that a lot of folks have already booked their vacations back in January, February, March, before the economy started to slow down here. So, I do expect that, we're going to, a rush of tourism coming in the summertime into the fall. But there's also Cape traffic. And I'm kind of curious, is people going to be, doing the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing and, kind of remote work from vacation, so to speak?
Yeah, I don't know. I read an article earlier this week that there are still a lot of rental vacancies on the Cape this year, more than in years past.
Yeah, that could be a reflection. People just, like I said, front-loaded their vacations in January to March, going to other parts of wherever they're going to go that isn't local. Mm. I do expect that. I think locally the Cape should be fine again. I think as people reevaluate their finances, if it's less competition for prices on the Cape, people are going to gravitate to Cape on short notice.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they might be able to get better deals that way. And another speculation was that so many folks that bought second homes during the pandemic are now trying to rent them. So that's, increasing the supply.
Interest rates were still wonderful during the pandemic period, and people were either passed away sadly or they moved to other places because they decided life change. Mm-hmm. Right? I think people over politicize why people move. People do have real lives. Life is not all about politics to every individual. They're not making statements. They're decided that they're ready for a lifestyle change, whether it be employment related or retirement related. Mm-hmm. And I have friends in the legislature that retired this past cycle, and big surprise, they're looking to downsize their home here, no kids at this point at the house, and they're trying to move to a climate that's better for them.
Yeah, nobody likes to shovel snow anymore, especially when you get to that point in life.
There is very true, as I talk to my friends that are moved on to enjoying the remaining years, I suppose. I mean, they're just looking for a better quality of life, and people, quality of life changes as they change, right? Quality of life, when you're younger, you have kids, school's a big component of quality of life.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
as you empty nest, quality of life changes again. And I think that's a big challenge that's going on with people. And you're right. I mean, people bought stuff during the pandemic, but you know, we talk about this a lot. Things are expensive.
Yeah.
And that includes home upkeep. And it's not going to get cheaper quickly, despite inflation is coming down, but it's coming out very slowly now. You had that big drop, and now it's just slowed down.
Yes. Yeah.
And we'll see where that takes us. So, and also the one of the drawbacks, and I'm not saying I'm not faulting anyone for this too, but one of the drawbacks of buying second homes around here is it takes away from the housing market, which then squeezes people who want to buy homes here because it jacks up the prices.
Right. Yeah, it does. It takes that property off the market at that point. Right. Exactly.
So you have unused property in this area, in the Massachusetts, there are, seasonal homes. That could, many of them probably could be four season homes. I can't speak for everyone else, but that takes a home off the market for anybody to actually try to buy a home in the state. And it squeezes because less supply equals higher prices.
That's right. Yeah. It's just like a commodity, just like oil, or gas. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, a lot, I know all these data sets running around saying, people are leaving the state. I told you all before, this ain't a new thing. I mean, people migrate by nature, but are you really migrating if you keep your second home here, but you're in Florida, but you're renting it out?
Good point. It's just something that you want to do during the winter.
Yeah, or you're just looking to make a little extra money for your winter home.
That too.
Everybody's got their own thing, and that's fine. But, I mean, these are kind of part of the realities of life we're living in Massachusetts, and people make their own choices, but it does have impact, oddly enough, at a macro level.
Any international issues you want to touch on, Techie? As we're speaking here today, there's this drama that's unfolding in the North Atlantic with that missing submersible.
Yeah, that's scary. I know that, we have things like, I did not realize there was submarine tourism. I'll be honest with you. I had no clue.
Same. It was news to me too.
Yeah. It makes you rethink space tourism, right? This is very frightening, and I feel really poorly for the families here trying to hopefully find these folks. And I can't imagine what it's like being in a small tin tube, a metal tube in the middle of an ocean down deep in the dark with other folks trying not to panic and consume their oxygen supply, much less the lack of food and water. And you got to somehow let people know you're down there. I mean, there was a report that perhaps there was a banging noise for every 30 minutes caught in sonar, and time's not on their side. The sub's designed to be down that deep, so it's not going to get crushed. But asphyxiation is not a great way to go.
A lot of resources, even from Boston and the Cape, are being poured into this effort.
Well, I'd like to say, if you need search and rescue and need emergency assistance, the United States is still the best in the world in doing it. And, it's also, the good job of, our Coast Guard that knows how to do these search missions and rescue. And I hope it's going to be a rescue.
Right.
To make this happen. And I think it's underappreciated by people here that we are among the best and the best in doing these things. And when people need help, they turn to us.
Yep, they did immediately. That's right. So we hope and pray certainly for a good outcome there for sure.
Yeah.
Also saw a report about the governance of Taiwan. Maybe you saw that as well. But how folks, Taiwanese people actually, are very lackadaisical about the threat from China.
This is kind of an interesting phenomenon, right? If you live with something long enough and nothing bad happens, no matter how much you talk about being bad, things happen, and it doesn't happen, and you think it's not going to happen. I had the same actually conversation many, many years now with people in Seoul, Korea. The North Koreans are basically artillery shells away from Seoul. I mean, it's not like you need modern weaponry. As you saw in the Ukraine war, World War II surplus is perfectly fine on causing devastation in dense urban areas. And North Koreans don't have, despite their videos, don't have really modern 21st century warfare stuff, but they have, artillery shells from World War II. And even if the shell doesn't detonate, it does enormous damage just coming down as dead weight through buildings, right? I mean, you don't have to have shells. I mean, catapults throwing big rocks and other junk were perfectly effective. ruining lines of villages and causing chaos on cities, right? So it's one of those funny phenomena where, you know, you get so used to it that you think it's not going to happen. You just kind of act like, you know, it's just a way of life. Because if you think about it too much, it's going to make you crazy.
Right. Just because there's not a lot the average person can do about it, right?
That is correct. You know, you're living in a potential war zone in South Korea and Taiwan all the time. And the Japanese are actually kind of in the same phenomena, because even though they're not directly adjacent, they're ballistic missile able, you know, friends in North Korea can cause some serious damage. And of course, you got the Chinese Navy also floating around near Korea, near Japan. And you got the same thing happening in the Philippines. So while, you know, you got, so people just kind of have to just live their lives, and, you know, we take it as it comes. And something we're not familiar with here, really, about the fact that you could have someone, you know, less than 30 miles from you just drop big weapons on you from afar and never actually have to set foot on your land to do it.
Right. Yeah. Think if Canada was a hostile neighbor, then we'd be a little nervous.
Or New Hampshire.
Yes, I'm sure some people would say it is.
It's actually a more apt example because it's geographically closer, right?
Right.
If you could lob, you know, war to artillery from the edge of New Hampshire to Boston.
Sure.
Yeah, literally lob, because I don't think you have great weapons in North Korea. But China, of course, has significantly more 21st century weapons. They have targeted ballistic systems. They have, you know, cruise missiles. They have all the stuff that we have.
Oh, yeah. And good Air Force, too.
Air Force and a functional Navy. We talk about blue water navies. It's not quite truly a U.S. blue water Navy, but they don't need a full blue water Navy. They just got to be able to control the water near themselves. Mm-hmm. You don't need 9 aircraft carriers or 11 aircraft carriers or 13 aircraft. So the U.S., you know, in U.S. Ronald Reagan, if you're the Chinese, you just have to control the water where you are. And they can do that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, the Taiwanese do have mandatory service training, safe as South Koreans. You know, you do have to do that training. But, you know, you trained, with, you know, 25 years ago. You know, like, you know, your mid-40s or whatever. I mean, that was still 25 years ago.
Right.
So, you know, combat readiness is a little bit kind of like how you want to look at it. And also, let's be honest about it. I mean, it's a first world economy. They're all first world economies. And these are folks that are enjoyed everything you're enjoying, just differently, but enjoying the same things. And you're not inclined to want to, you know, learn how to use a machine gun.
Exactly. You'd more be apt to want to go to school and learn how to be a computer technician or something, right?
Yeah. You know, doctor, tech, whatever, small business owner, whatever you want to do, right? It's, you know, and if you visit these countries, I hope everyone has a chance to visit these countries. You can find, you know, how, first world countries look at other places. Yeah, they're different, but they're also very the same.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Will we see you in the district anytime soon, Tacky?
Well, this morning I was at the Goodwill store down on Southern Artery doing the ribbon cutting. It's great to see the renovations and a quick tour. You know, saw Quincy Chamber President Tim Kao there. You know, they do great work. They do a lot of workforce development stuff. I didn't realize how much workforce development they did until we talked to some of the folks who work there. It's more than just a thrift store or a discount retailer, depending on how you want to frame it. And they gave us a fascinating statistics today. The Quincy store generated $1.9 million thus far in gross sales. When you're selling items no greater than $5, $4.99, and you generate $1.9 million in sales, that's pretty impressive. And it's also a reflection of the economy we're living in. You know, obviously you get donations from big stores. But, I mean, you know, the public, all of us, you know, can donate lightly used or, you know, not heavily damaged clothing and other goods to the Goodwill. And, you know, a lot of those... everyone, you know, needs clothes, I hope.
Except for those people on the balcony at the State House.
The State Senate got a special moonlight view, I guess.
That's right.
But But no, I mean, also that money goes back to support the Goodwill programs, and you know, that's actually also important as well. It's a real need on several levels, not just as a store, but also you know, providing important services to folks that are looking to get ahead in life. And that's
win for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, as I said today, you know, they help people look good the way they want to look good, because if you're going to get a job interview, you know, you got to look presentable. Depending on what office environment you work in, you look presentable. But you know, I mean, take it from a guy that wears a suit all the time. I mean, it's expensive. And a place like Goodwill store is a good place to find lightly used clothes. You know, it's not, and it's also cyclical. Like once you get to moving season, right? When there's a, particularly when we get to end of August into September, there's a lot of people moving. A lot of things end up at Goodwill stores, particularly professional clothing and other stuff. I mean, I got Joseph A. Bank shirt there at one point. It was lightly used, you know, had a few loose threads, but you know, it was, you know, hardly a problem. Yeah. But I mean, it was like, hey, you know, here's a decent find. I mean, so I think this shirt I'm wearing here was a Goodwill store purchase as well. So, you know, I do, you know, it's not a bad place to look for stuff. Again, it's a combination of not just people think of it as just strictly, you know, people that made donations. It's not. It's also, you know, major stores that, you know, have surplus and, you know, looking for some place to move some of their goods into a charitable organization where it can really do well for other people.
Yeah, and employs people as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, they're an employer. I mean, people sorting and confirming that things are able to be sold. People stock the stores and people that they help find stuff for you. You know, it's a good thing to do. It's a good place to visit. I do advise folks to you know, at least make one trip in, and you never know, you find something that's really wonderful. Tomorrow, I'm actually at the another ribbon cutting. It's suddenly we're in ribbon cutting, right? We're doing ribbon cutting at the Manor Community Health Center in North Quincy. I'll stop by tomorrow morning. Tonight, I'm actually going to be at the Work Inc. Awards dinner. This is their annual dinner. Work Inc. is the largest employer of individuals with developmental disability issues to train and help find work. Today we're going to hear from some, tonight we're going to hear some signature employees as well as consumers of the agency and see where they're going and you know, I bought a raffle ticket and all that stuff. So I'll be there this evening, learning about how people are getting ahead in life and you know, great work being done at the agency. So yeah, I got a busy evening. This has been a busy week. I had a public hearing yesterday. It's a short week, but it was a busy week.
Sounds like it. Yeah, and a lot of good stuff going on. Work Inc. does an incredible job. They are a wonderful organization. They used to be in Quincy, actually. So they have local roots.
Yeah, there were three Arlington Street before heading to the Dorchester location. And then there, I believe, was out in Squantum in an old factory house way back, I think, over 50 years. I think we're closing.
Sounds right. Yeah.
And those who may know Henry Levin, who passed away last year, 1111, he's an attorney. He's been with the agency since day one. And he was the longest serving board member, and Henry put a lot of time, effort, and love into working. We always very much appreciate Henry.
Yeah. And Manit, as you mentioned, they're getting the new radiology lab, so that's great as well.
Yeah, I mean, one-stop service, community health centers are considered to be crucial healthcare providers. You know, they take a lot of folks on Medicare and Medicaid, as well as private insurance. And the more one-stop shopping services you have at health centers, particularly the big, you know, the kind of the flagship one in North Quincy, and the better it is for everybody. And, you know, we don't want, people prefer not to be shuffled around. And, you know, time is hard and everyone's got a job. Very clear unemployment ratios, everybody's got a job. You know, you can't take as much time away. And you know, if you can get all your lab work done in one place or schedule in the place, you know where it's going to be, and you don't have to like transverse into Boston or Waltham or Framingham or Weymouth. Yeah, it's a good time to know where some of these labs are. you know, that makes easy it is for Quincy and other social residents and people, you know, with their manic customers. So this is wonderful. It's wonderful to see provide more services. Yep. Congratulations, Cynthia Sierra, Massachusetts Community Health Centers, gave an award as the CEO of the year of Community Health Centers. It's wonderful to see Cynthia recognized by her peers for the incredible work at Manet and, you know, leading a ship through some really tough times the last 3-4 years as our health centers have had.
Absolutely. Well-deserved. And we'll be featuring her here on QATV in the near future. So and I'd folks to look out for that. Time to tell folks how to get a hold of you, Jackie.
Well, phone number is 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370. Please wait a while. Jerry Paracella's name comes up first, not Chan. It is not alphabetical. So you do have to wait a little bit. So please do. If the phone doesn't pick up, we do have people in the office. We have people pick up the phones. But if you're on the phone, you can't pick up the second phone. And it goes to voicemail, which is an automated system. So I think people kind of forget this ain't, we don't have a switchboard style phone system anymore. It's the 21st century everyone. Those things don't exist in our world anymore. You know, obviously tacky.chan at mahealth.gov, tackey.chan at mahealth.gov is the email. Right now I'm getting flooded with testimony. We're still in public hearing season. So, you know, I sift through my email and you know, staff actually sifts through it a second time in case I missed something the first time. But I do sift through my email and try to make sure I identify issues that are important on constituent services first. Always constituent services first. We have State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook account. You know, we put up pictures where I've been and put in information that's useful that we hope the public can benefit from. Tackingchin.org is another one. It's an information resource page more than anything else. And of course, at Tacky Chan. At Tacky Chan Twitter, again, another resource page. We do encourage people not to social media message. We do not pay attention to them. We're getting scammed a lot and we're getting junk flooded with like, you know, please click here bait. So we definitely do encourage people to email, call the office directly. Obviously mahealth.gov, state website, public hearings are now on the state website. They are recorded. So, you know, if you can't come to a public hearing for any bill you find important, you can watch the recording, you can email the committee with your testimony if you care to. You also can, you know, see when the hearing schedule is to virtually testify and look up bills on your own so you don't have to check in with us where your bill is. It's on the internet, folks. And, of course, QATV with me and Joel and the QATV podcast as well as QATV YouTube. So I did listen to Joe this morning for his 3-minute introduction of what's going on. Hey, do you encourage everyone to do the same?
Thank you. Appreciate that, Tacky. Have a great week.
You too. Enjoy the next couple of days, and I'll see you hopefully in the week's time.